You're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. On this week's show, I talk to Ken Friedman, record industry big shot turned restaurateur extraordinaire. Back in the day, Ken dropped out of UC Berkeley, go Bears, to work with the likes of the Smiths and UB40 and U2 and all those big bands of the 80s and 90s. But then at some point, he was like, you know what? I've had enough. I'm getting out. And he decided to open a restaurant. And that restaurant was The Spotted Pig over 10 years ago here in New York City. And the years since, he and Chef April Bloomfield have gone on to open The Breslin and John Dory Oyster Bar and Salvation Taco and White Gold, not to mention Tosca Restaurant in San Francisco and their soon-to-open venture in Los Angeles. I talked to Ken what his younger years were like, how he became a rock star in the restaurant world with absolutely no experience, and what it's like to have Jay-Z send you a check. But hey, before we get to Ken, remember, we love to hear from you guys. Tell us what you like. Tell us what you want to hear more of. Tell us what you want to hear less of. The feedback really helps, and we totally make decisions based on that for upcoming shows. So bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. And if you're feeling nice, go to iTunes and rate us on the iTunes store, and that helps us a lot also. All right, here's Ken Friedman. Ken Friedman, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Adam. Nice to be here.
I've known you for a while and through kind of restaurant world and that sort of stuff. But one thing I was thinking about, like, I've never actually had the opportunity to ask how you got where you are today. And I've known you as Ken, but I'm like, I know you used to be in the music business, but what did exactly that mean? And you opened Spotted Pig and you got all these famous people to give you money. And I'm like, how does that work? And what can we go back? Can we go back to your beginnings in the Bay Area, correct?
Yeah. Well, beginnings were L.A. Grew up in L.A.
Like in the 1940s?
And thank you for that. Early 1840s.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am quite old, I admit it. Actually, it's funny because I used to be, I was always the youngest person, and now I'm always the oldest
person. Isn't that weird how you go from being like,
and
you're like,
all of a sudden,
you're like this young up-and-comer in the music biz, and now all of a sudden you're like old guy Ken.
I'm the old, you know, I'm going to give you my very first of a long series of name dropping. I'm going to start now. We had Charlie Rose's 75th birthday party the other week at the Spotted Pig, and I just loved it. And the reason why I loved it is I was not the oldest person in the room.
Yes.
I knew at least one person was older than me, Charlie, 75. I'm pretty sure other people were there. Henry Kissinger, I'm pretty sure, is older than me.
Kissinger was there?
He was there. So yeah, grew up in L.A. and you went to UC Berkeley, as someone else I know did.
Yeah, both went to Cal. Yep. And then you were, when were you at Cal?
Well, I'm going to give away my age then. But
yeah,
I was
sure.
There, started in 78, I guess. And then dropped out many times, but finally dropped out like 81. So I dropped out three times.
What does that mean? And they just let you come back?
I was in the art department, so it's all. So what happened at Berkeley was pretty much 100% of the art department at Berkeley formed punk rock bands in the late 70s. And the punk rock scene in San Francisco was all art students.
Dead Kennedys, right? They were.
Dead Kennedys were like second wave. LA punk scene didn't start till the Damned and then the Ramones toured. But San Francisco and New York was art students.
This is where I give my PSA announcement to the listeners. We will get to food eventually. All right. So kind of the nascent moment of the punk rock scene as it's coming to America, late 70s.
And
you're into it.
I'm playing in punk bands, so I dropped out of college to play in punk bands.
What were you playing?
I was in three different bands. I played drums in one, keyboards in another, and bass guitar in another one.
Did you play any of those instruments well?
No. I basically would drop out of Berkeley because I wanted to like be in San Francisco, the big city. You know?
See, I was at Cal a lot after you because I'm a lot younger than you. That was I had this feeling like you were at Berkeley's beautiful school, big campus, that stadium on the hill. But you look across the water and like, oh, there's the real city.
The city.
Yeah. And I always had that sort of pull, and this may be why I live in New York now, but I always wanted to go across the bridge and check things out. And very few other kids that I was at school with had any interest in that. They're like, no, we're good here. This is all
right.
Good. And
right.
I'm like, I used to remember I subscribed to Gourmet back in those days.
Wow.
RIP. And I would read, they would have the California restaurant reviews. And they'd have New York City, and I would read the ones in California. When they did San Francisco, I would like tear them out, and I would like I'm going to go to that restaurant. And I'd try to get some girl or someone to come with me.
Wow.
And they always thought I was a little bit weird. But I'm like, no, I read about this in Gourmet. We're going to the Cypress Room. Or, right. You know.
And they had a little illustration of
Yeah. I remember. So it was cool. As a college kid, you know, you're basically subsisting on burritos and pizza at that point, but then going into the big city for a moment of sophistication.
Right.
So you were playing punk rock. And at what point were you like, you know what? I'm not going back to school.
The point at which, when I realized my bands that I was in were so bad that no one would book them, no clubs would book them to play, so I just start putting on shows in Barrington Hall. I started, you know, the kind of hippie dorm, you know, Barrington Hall.
Yeah, sure.
Barrington Hall
at Berkeley
was a famous dorm where all, like, you know, kind of hippies stayed there, and a lot of homeless Telegraph Avenue people would live there, like Pink Cloud and the Fuck You Guy and the Bubble Lady. Remember the Bubble Lady on Telegraph?
No.
Come on.
No, dude.
I think she's still there.
She's still there.
You just didn't spend enough time wandering Telegraph Avenue late at night like I did. So, yeah, I started putting on shows in Barrington Hall just so my own bands could play. And it just got to the point where then I was starting to do all the San Francisco bands because they wanted to play in Berkeley. So I booked the Avengers and the Dills and the Nuns and Crime and, like I said, Negative Trend. And then later—
And so you're early 20s at this point?
Yeah, I'm like 20.
You're a kid.
Yeah, I'm 21 and stuff. And then that led to, I went to work for Bill Graham in San Francisco.
And so, explain Bill Graham for our younger listeners who might not know Bill Graham.
I mean, Bill Graham was a total legend in the music business.
Like a legit legend.
For real legend. He had the Fillmore West, the Fillmore East. You know who he was.
Yeah, Fillmore East is in New York, Fillmore West out in San Francisco.
And he would bring, I mean, the British Invasion was basically Bill Graham having The Who and The Kinks and all these bands come to America. I mean, he had these bands come to America because he had a place in New York and a place in San Francisco. So they would build a tour around Bill Graham saying, come to America.
Was it Bill Graham Presents? Was that the official name?
BGP, yeah. Bill Graham Presents, yeah. And he would do, and then he would do Monsters of Rock, you know, in Oakland Stadium. Oh, yeah. And he had Winterland, a big 8,000 capacity, although he told the bands it was a 5,000 capacity place. And he would, so I
is so, that so he could take the extra money and not give it to him?
What do you think?
Yeah.
He also wouldn't tear tickets. And no one, people were like, well, how come you're taking the whole ticket from me? Well, if you think about why he would take the whole ticket from you.
I don't know why.
Because that ticket was sold two or three or four times. He wouldn't tear the ticket. He'd take your ticket and then they go sell it again.
That was how
they would do it back then.
Legend.
A legend, yeah, a legend of making money.
So how did you get hooked up with him?
He found me. I mean, he was a smart guy, and he was just there's some kid doing these shows with bands with names like the Buzzcocks and the Gang of Four and Susie and the Banshees and Iggy Pop and Lena Lovitch, and you know, so he himself would come to my gigs. Bill Graham would show up, and I was doing like a show with 999 at California Hall or someplace I rented.
Were you living in Berkeley this time or San Francisco?
I was now in San Francisco, living over in the Haight and renting various halls to do shows. The California Hall over on Polk Street, the Geary Temple, also called the Temple Beautiful.
Yep.
I did a Gang of Four show, a Buzzcocks show there.
And what's fascinating about this point? So I grew up in D.C. in the '80s when the punk rock scene was very fervent back then.
Fugazi.
Fugazi, all that.
Shutter to Think.
Rites of Spring, all those guys.
Yep. And Bad Brains.
What was interesting about then was how much of a sort of community it was and how word of mouth it was. There was no internet. There was no email. You literally got on. I'm sure you just had to call someone and
put up posters. And
posters
stuff.
Up and like
fanzines.
Someone called you, say, hey, we want to bring the Buzzcocks over. Can you do a show? And
Yeah. Well, what happened was what Bill Graham did is the same thing that smart agents, most of whom were in New York, would do. They'd figure out who was – they'd find me.
Yeah, they'd know, oh, you got to call Kent. He's the guy in
right.
San Francisco.
Right.
And you'd get a call, and next thing you know
– Yeah.
So you have a legit business at this point. You're like, I don't need to graduate college. Wait, so you're not a college graduate?
No.
So you walk around with all this California Golden Bear paraphernalia. You're wearing you wore a Cal sweatshirt in here, and you actually didn't even graduate from Cal.
No.
Wow.
No.
I don't –
That's but I mean, I wear, you know, New York Knicks stuff, and I don't play for the Knicks. So I mean,
no, you don't. Know. Well, you're kind of tall. You are tall, though.
It's a bit of a,
they could use you right now.
Yeah.
Okay. So
they could use anything.
So you got your promotion business going. You're making decent money at this point, like
For a 23-year-old, I'm making like great money because I'm working for the biggest promoter in the world, probably. And I'm his like new wave punk rock guy.
You're the cool young guy.
I'm like he's like there's a band called The Clash. I keep hearing about. Who are they? I'm like. The Clash are fucking legends. Like, The Clash wanted to hire me. I'd leave you in a second. What are you talking about?
What was your first introduction to food at this point? Were you eating at all, or were you just drinking and smoking the whole time?
No, I mean, I was fascinated with public assembly in general. So I loved restaurants and bars. And Chez Panisse is where I kind of really sort of, you know, Chez Panisse was like the mecca, right? It still is. So I got to go to Chez Panisse and walk in there, and you could kind of get goosebumps and feel something's going on there.
When was the first time you went, and who'd you go with?
The first time I went was early on. My friend Tony Myland.
Early on meaning what?
Probably in 1978.
Oh, that early? Wow.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
So who took you, though? You were like an 18-year-old.
I was probably 20, but yeah. Two things happened. I dated a girl who worked there. Okay. That was the main thing.
That's good.
So, you know, and she'd like bring home all this, you know, food from, and it was like something amazing.
She would bring home like one peach. But it was a perfect peach. Right, exactly. This is Chez Panisse, kid.
Right. I'm thinking of that scene in Godfather when he brought home one peach. But then also, I had a friend, Tony Myland, who unfortunately passed away a few years ago, but he was like a super sophisticated guy from the Bay Area, from Vallejo near Berkeley. And he sort of told me about how important Chez Panisse was and how Alice Waters was the one that sort of told people, stop importing stuff from Italy and France. You know, the best food is, you know, when you're eating goat cheese from that goat right there.
Yeah.
So he sort of taught me that like this place is really special. And then I got to know Alice.
What was she like back then?
She was, you know, flirty really? and yeah, trying to hang out with young dudes like me.
It's the 70s, it's California.
In fact, one of my great friends, Steve Singer, she married, and they have a great daughter, Fanny Singer, and she named Fanny's, her little place she had after Fanny.
So you get introduced to new kind of California cuisine and that movement. Do you remember other restaurants at the time in those sort of early 80s in California or in San Francisco? Were there the ones that you got hip to?
Well, so what happened was there was Santa Fe Bar and Grill on University going up to, you know, you'd go up to Berkeley from the freeway. That was great. 4th Street Grill, you know, down at 4th Street in Berkeley, mm-hmm. Mark Miller had it. They were all Chez Panisse alums. Jeremiah Tower, who had Santa Fe Bar and Grill, also had a place called Stars in San Francisco. And that was a real game changer for me because it was Chez Panisse, but like in the big city, like we were saying, like across the bay. Like
it had pizzazz.
It had pizzazz. And also he made it where you could see every table from every table. So like, everybody who walked in could see the room, and you were there, right?
I went there with when my roommate's parents from New York came 1 year in like 1992 or something or 91, and they had their list of places they were going to go, and I was lucky enough they took us, but we went to like Stars. So it was sort of the tail end of Stars, but you still walk in, you're like, oh, I mean, it's kind of like Balthazar in New York where there's that energy, everyone sees each other. And there's that. What I love about that there's that good restaurants have a there's a sense of drama where you walk in, you just feel it. You're like, oh,
yep.
I'm somewhere. Like, that's cool right now.
Right.
It's happening.
Stars was the place to be. And I started going there right because I knew Jeremiah from Chez Panisse and then from Santa Fe Bar and Grill on University in Berkeley. So, yeah, like I started kind of going there. I was super young. You know, at this point, I think I was just starting to work for Bill Graham, so like I had a credit card that worked and stuff.
But I mean, it's interesting. Like when getting back to when I was at Berkeley and going out to dinner at restaurants, a lot of younger people, especially in places like Berkeley, the notion of going to a nice restaurant and paying a lot of money for a meal was kind of like, what? Why would you want to do that? Like, right, you know what I mean? Like, it's just like, why we can just go to this bar and hang out instead. Was that strange for you to be a 23, 24 year old? And
no, I was sort of used to like, again, like public assembly. I was used to like, I mean, I was like going out all the time because I was playing in bands, putting on shows with bands, going to see bands. And then I loved going to bars and I always just loved going out.
Yeah.
And I would like go sit at a bar by myself instead of stay in my little apartment in Berkeley. So I was kind of used to that from early on. And going to, like you say, like the kind of the drama, like walking into Chez Panisse, I could have sort of got goosebumps. I could tell something was going on here. And same with Stars. You could have kind of walked in. And Balthazar is a very good analogy because it's the same kind of thing. You can see every seat from every seat. The lighting's perfect. Everything's perfect.
And but that's also akin to bands. Like when you see a band like The Clash back in 1979, you're like, wow. Like hair stands up on your arms. You're like, you know that there's something going on here.
Right.
You know, and you can just sense that, which was your job back then, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, I was always kind of a talent scout, you know, trying to figure out who was cool. And I mean, when The Clash played for us, for Bill Graham, at the Berkeley Community Theater the first time, you know, I thought it was the wrong venue because it had seats, But Bill was going to put him in a club. And I said, no, this is the Clash. They're the kings of, they're going to sell out a big, huge place. I wanted to put him in a bigger place, but Bill had never really heard of him. So put him in the Berklee Community Theater, and it sold out in 2 seconds, 3,500 seats. And we added a show, and it was a goosebump show. It was like, wow, these guys are, they're not the kind of what I thought punk rock bands in England like didn't want to be famous. Mm-hmm. And the Clash like wanted
they
to be famous.
They look good.
They had like choreography. The hair. Looked perfect. Yeah, perfect. And the leather jackets with the colors turned up and stuff. Yeah.
So you had this magical time in San Francisco, both with the music scene and the birth of, like I said, that sort of kind of new California cooking from Alice Waters to Jeremiah Tower to Mark Miller. Mm-hmm. At what point did New York come calling? When did you leave the Bay Area?
Well, New York came calling. I used to get the Village Voice like delivered when I was I was living in San Francisco and stuff. I always kind of wanted to. I was obsessed with New York, and I used to come to New York every year to a thing called the New Music Seminar. It was just a kind of a punk rock new wave thing, and I'd come every year and loved it, and stay up all night, go to after hours clubs, and it was great. But I left the Bay Area to go to L.A. because I was working for Bill Graham, and I was just bored because when you work for a kind of a big company, any big company, in a way, it's sort of, it's hard to be creative because you're just part of a cog. So I wanted to actually work with, I was a frustrated artist. Like that defines everything I've ever done. I really wanted to be an artist, but I just wasn't. I was an art major, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do, sculpture or painting or printmaking or whatever. Then I was a musician. I wasn't any good. So I started putting on shows, but I kept wanting to get closer to the artist. So I left Bill Graham and moved to L.A. to manage bands, L.A. where I'm from. And I found that really the bands I wanted to manage weren't in L.A. They were in the U.K. All my favorite bands were in the U.K. This is now 1985. And so I became the American manager for Simple Minds and UB40. And a band called Shriekback.
And that means that when they would come to the States, you'd sort of...
I would get them a record deal in America and do their tours in America. But then again, I realized, I want to be like the fifth member of the band. Yeah. I want to be, with them, like helping get involved. And I thought that I'd get involved in helping to make the records and book the tours and think of the graphics and all that stuff. So I moved to London. I was 25. I guess at this point, moved to London and became the manager, the worldwide manager for UB40, and I became the manager of the Smiths, who I'd heard of. Yeah. So I got to manage the Smiths, a band I thought was going to be the biggest band in the world. They had this formula that the Rolling Stones have and Aerosmith have and every kind of rock band has.
What is that formula?
The kind of androgynous, poetic, singer kind of, and the kind of drug-taking, cigarette-smoking, model shagging guitar player. They had that same formula when you think about it. They were Jagger Richards.
Yeah.
REM had that formula. Like all the bands that were important in their generation, had that. And they had Morrissey, who wrote the best lyrics of anybody, of his generation and maybe any generation. And Johnny, who was an acute student of rock and roll, could play every song, every riff, knew everything that Keith Richards and Joe Perry and Pete Townsend and Eric Clapton ever wrote. So, and they got more press in the UK, at least, than any band ever, in such a short period of time.
But I always thought, like, growing up in the 80s, like, there was something so British about the Smiths that didn't quite translate to mainstream America. There was something a little hard to grasp about them.
Same thing, the Kinks, why the Kinks never really made it big here. Why the Who never really made it big till way late in their career when you think about it, because they were so British. Same thing. But I always thought that the Smiths were like the Who, like the Stones. They had that same formula, and they would be massive. I mean, they were... When they finally came and toured America, it was a major tour. The problem is only a few dates, and they canceled lots of them, and it was all chaos.
What was there? I went and visited my brother in London in the late 80s or so. He was at drama school there. There was not a lot of good food back in London in the late 80s, early 90s.
There wasn't good food in London until very recently. I think that. Like what's happening in LA now is what happened in England, in London specifically, 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
A bunch of really talented, mostly young cooks and chefs with a chip on their shoulder, which is a really good thing. They want to prove something to the world that, you know, that we actually grow great food here and we can make great food here. And it's not just mushy, gray vegetables where you dump out the bright green water, and fish and chips and stuff. So yeah, there wasn't great food at all there, but I just loved, like, I loved being in England. I just loved I loved the weather. I grew up in Southern California. You know, it's 72 degrees every day. So I loved everything about, mainly what I loved was going to a pub where people have been drinking in that pub for like hundreds of years in that same room. I just thought that was fascinating.
And there's that smell. Like, it was kind of like
that musty
aged beer, cigarette. It's just like it's baked in there. And you're like, oh, I feel at home here.
Right, right.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Right. So it went, so all right. So in, you know, this, you get, at what point then you come back to the States? At what point did you even start thinking about, oh, I might want to open a restaurant one day?
I always thought it'd be fun to do that because I spent my whole life in clubs. So I always thought about, like, you know, I want to put on my own shows again, and I want to throw parties. And then eventually that led to, like, I should do my own club or maybe a restaurant. And so I always kind of made mental notes. I always thought, well, if I did a restaurant, I would do this differently. I would always kind of do that. And because I went out every night, I had a lot of mental notes.
You know? Yeah, I hope you remembered them.
But it wasn't really until I moved to New York and I started actually going to the Hamptons. I discovered the Hamptons and would rent a house with friends every year in the Hamptons starting in 1990 when I moved here. And I just realized, wow, I'm really good at throwing parties and barbecues and stuff. Like, I'm good at this. And that's when I started thinking, this would be fun. And then my friends would start to say, yeah, you're great at this. You really love, you have a passion for this. You're not so good at the music thing, but you're good at the throwing a party thing. That's when I started to think, well, maybe I should do this. It'd be fun. And as years went by, I was like, I realized, you know, restaurants are clubs for adults. You know, you, instead of taking drugs, maybe you eat.
Yeah. Drink wine.
Yeah.
So you know, you start to, after a while, you're getting a little burnt out on the music business, long nights, all that sort of stuff. And in the early 2000s, I guess you start thinking for real, like, wait a minute, maybe I should get out of this business and get into a new one. What was that? What was that moment?
The minute I turned 40, I had kind of a classic midlife crisis. I had one of those, what am I doing with my life? Do I really care what young kids are going to be buying next year? What music they, like, I sort of didn't love music at that point anymore. I was kind of burnt on it. Like, I kind of.
But that's like also, that was, music was lame then, late 90s. Right. Like, you bet the, like, you had that kind of those later years of grunge, like Alice in Chains and Creed. And it's just like.
All the bands with numbers in their names, all those dumb bands.
The bad, the
Seven
fake
Mary
punk bands.
Three and
Three Doors
Blink
Down.
One something. Yeah, all those number bands. Yeah, they were terrible. That's when, so then what I did was I thought, well, so I got really into electronic music because I thought, well, that's like.
But also that's such a, that's that at that point certainly was such a, still a British thing. Like, America
totally British.
Was not really into the
right.
EDM sort of shit, you know?
Right. So what I did was I left Arista Records to go open London Records U.S. label, right? Friends of mine from when I lived in England. Mm-hmm. So they were basically a pop and electronic label. So I was trying to find what I liked because I didn't like rock anymore. And I was about to turn 40. And I was standing in a club holding a beer, watching some guy in the late 90s sing about his personal problems, kind of, you know, with a flannel shirt on. And I just thought, gazing at his shoes, and I just thought, I don't care about this guy at all. I don't care. I don't give a fuck about this guy. So So yeah, so I just, so I turned 40, had a midlife crisis, was kind of thinking, do I want to be that guy that looks back on his life and says, God, I wish I'd tried this other thing that I think I might've been good at. And something else happened, which is Napster. When Napster happened, and I remember hearing about, wow, you can like email a song to somebody. What a great idea, that's awesome. And then the record industry of which I was part of responded by suing college students personally for like, for swapping songs without paying for them. And I remember thinking like, guys, we should embrace this. This is, we shouldn't be suing people. This is like, everyone's gonna do this. Whether you say it's okay or not, I'm gonna email songs to people.
Cat's out of the bag.
Yeah, so yeah. I remember just thinking, this is a bunch of idiots run this industry. And of course I was right. I mean, the only company that really made money in the music industry was Apple, because they were smart enough to monetize that. So I remember just thinking like, I should go do this thing. Like all these people over the years have said, I'll invest if you open a restaurant. So I thought, well, I'm gonna go to them because they're gonna stop offering if I don't go to them. So I did. I went to like the eight people that had said, give me a call when you're ready.
Who were those people?
I went to the most famous people's representatives. I didn't know Jay-Z, but I knew his lawyer and manager really well. So I went to them and they said, you know, we'll get Jay. So the first time I met Jay, he handed me a check for $50,000.
But why? Why would he hand you, Ken Friedman, a check?
Because I pitched him on what I wanted to do. And he said, you're right. You're right. There are no bars with great food in New York. And you're right. It is fun to go hang out in a bar and be able to eat food as great as any restaurant.
That you don't have to go to the club with the velvet rope and all that nonsense. You can actually go to a cool bar. You went to your friends and you too, yes?
Yeah.
Bono's one of the investors?
Indeed.
Edge, maybe? I don't know.
The band.
The Edge. We call him The Edge. We call him Edge. What do we call him?
I think people now just call him E.
E. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And people call the singer B.
Oh, that's weird.
It's weird. But, yeah.
All right, so you hit on your famous friends.
I went to Michael Stipe, who's a friend. You know, who's been a friend for years. People who had said to me over the years, wow, you're great at this. You should do this.
I'll give you $50,000 or $100,000.
I didn't know anything. I thought I had to raise $400,000. So I went to eight people and got $50,000 each.
What did you actually have to raise to open the Spotted Pig, which is a townhouse sort of setting in the West Village, nice neighborhood?
It wasn't townhouse then. It was just one floor then.
Okay, yeah.
We then had to go to Jay and – I went to Jay first to say, this building's about to get sold. I have 72 hours to find a buyer. Since you gave me the first, he gave me the second $50,000, actually. Mm-hmm. The U2 camp gave me the first $50,000. I went to Jay, and Jay bought the whole building for us, kind of so we wouldn't get evicted. And then loaned us $1 million to build the second and third floors.
And the second floor is basically another dining room and bar, and the third floor is still today a private dining room party space that people can rent out.
Yeah.
And when folks like Jay are around, they can go up there and hang out in.
Don't have to rent it.
Yes, if someone's not renting already. So you end up spending and borrowing a lot more money than you expected.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, par for the course for the restaurant industry.
I wasn't married. I'm still not. I didn't have kids.
You are engaged, though, young man.
I'm engaged. Yes. Yeah, I know. She said yes for no apparent reason. Yeah. So I didn't have a mortgage or kids, so I quit my job in the music business thinking I'll open a restaurant whenever. I had enough money kind of saved where I wasn't – if it didn't work, I wouldn't be like homeless.
But you were in deeper than what you thought you were going to be in, right?
Well, no. Then I ended up spending because it didn't cost $400,000. Yeah. It cost like $600,000. So I spent everything I had, every cent I had, and I had to borrow a little bit of money even to open the Spotted Pig. But – so at that point, like I was like, damn, this better work out or I'm screwed.
Okay, let me ask you this, Ken. I'm not entirely sure how to phrase this. You are not – you're not exactly the most fastidious, anal retentive guy in the world. So what made you think that you could run a restaurant, which is like – it's all the business and the numbers and the staff and like the permits and all that nonsense. What convinced you that you could do that and make a profit from running this thing?
I believe then what I believe now, because I don't know any that much more honestly than I did then about like running a restaurant and finances and labor costs and food costs. I believe then, as I do now, that butts and seats solves everything. That if I could get customers to come and give us their money in exchange for a great experience, it would all kind of work out.
Figure it out.
And that's really the case. And my best restaurant friend in New York then and now, Mario Batali, said to me, yeah, pretty much that's, that is, you're right, that pretty much is it. between you and me and now the listening audience, he's like, I'm the same. I just make great food and I make sure the experience is great and other people take care of it.
Yeah, but he also has a partner who's a money guy. Joe Bastianich is like fastidious money guy. Did you take on a partner or did you just hire various managers and such?
I just hired a bookkeeper to mm-hmm. – I hired a bean counter, and I just said, I'm going to make sure there's enough beans for you to count.
Okay, all right. So you've got a townhouse. You've got your famous investor friends signed on. You're building this thing out, and then you're like, oh, shit, I need a chef.
Yeah. So what happened was, you know, I always thought, you know, punk rock, back to punk rock, like do things differently, like question authority. Don't just do what everyone tells you to do. So my friend Mario was like, yeah, meet this guy. He used to work for me. And meet this guy. He used to work for Danielle. And this guy is about to leave Jean-Georges. And I'm meeting all these guys, first of all. And they all used to work for somebody. And they're all New Yorkers. And I was like, I want something different, something sexy. Like I kind of want to do, I don't necessarily want to call it a gastropub, but I want to do what's happening in England now, like a pub with a real chef in the kitchen. So I want like somebody English or—
You opened in 2004, right?
2004.
Yeah, so we're leading up to that.
Yeah.
The gastropub thing is happening in London.
Yeah, and I just didn't want all the cooks I was meeting weren't right. I wanted something different. So Jamie Oliver was a friend of mine that I met at a wedding of Norman Cook, Fat Boy Slim, a great friend of mine who also invested, was one of the eight people that put 50,000 in. And I met Jamie years before at his wedding. And Jamie was a friend at this point. He was coming to town. And I said, Mario, do you know Jamie Oliver? He said, yeah, I know Jamie. You know, we're going to hang out together. Let's all have dinner with him. Let's see if he'll be my chef. So of course Jamie's like, fuck you, no way. I'm Mr. Big over there in England. But
where did you have dinner with them?
At Babbo.
Okay. Yeah.
Babbo, which was, you know, had opened pretty recently.
Yeah.
He said, you know, there's two people that you should consider. There's two people that one I work with and the other one I almost work with. April and he kind of didn't overlap actually at River Cafe. But he said, you should meet this guy, Pete, who's kind of obsessed with America and wants to come to America. And this woman, April Bloomfield, who is a commis chef at River Cafe. She's kind of a rising star. And she's sort of obsessed with Alice Waters and Chez Panisse and wants to go spend time maybe a year or 6 months or something at Chez Panisse. Maybe you can hijack her for 6 months to stop in New York and work for you, you know, or maybe you'll convince her to stay. So I started emailing with both of them. And April and I just sort of, I liked her right away. You know, and Pete didn't actually want the job. He wanted to stay working for Jamie. And April was indeed going to leave River Cafe at some point to go and just, she'd never left England. You know, she'd been to Canada or something on a family holiday, maybe Disney World or one of the, but she hadn't really been to America. So so I said, Mario, what do we do? He said, well, we should meet her. I said, to do a tasting? He said, no, I don't need to do a tasting with her. I said, really? And I found out later that Mario was just going to base his decision on how many burns she had on her arm, which she had lots of burns on her arm, which showed him that she was a badass, that she would reach into hot ovens and stuff. So, but we spent some time together and she wanted the job and I liked the fact, because I've been saying, I've been saying to Mario, I want a woman or an English person, you know,
and so
there's an English woman.
So did you, at some point she must have cooked for you, right? Did you just talk food or did you actually eat her food?
We ate her food after she was hired.
Yeah. Really?
Yep. What happened was, I mean, we basically talked food and we just kind of got along and look, she worked at the River Cafe at Bibendum, at Kensington Place, at the Cow, all my favorite places, literally my favorite places when I lived in London, she worked at. So, and Mario said, go for it.
She's so you knew that you were on the same page food-wise with her. Interesting about April, like in this, speaking of Mario in this day and age of celebrity chefs, April is, I mean, she's much more kind of salt of the earth real person. She is not Jamie Oliver. She's not some outsized TV personality. What was your impression on that? And did you think, oh, I need a big name celebrity chef?
No, I mean, I like that she was, she was just kind of like a meat and potatoes, kind of like, salt of the earth, hardworking girl from Birmingham. Now, I have a connection to Birmingham. UB40, who I'd managed, were from Birmingham. So I knew Birmingham really well, and I knew that sense of humor, and I knew Birmingham's like Pittsburgh, Baltimore. Yeah. It's like salt of the earth, working class, like real God-fearing people. So I kind of liked that. She was obsessed with Chez Panisse, so was am I. She yeah. was, we just kind of had the same.
I'm a big believer in, like, you know, if you jive with someone, you know, if you vibe with them, and if you do, you're like, we can make this work.
Yeah.
So Spotted Pig opens. It is sort of an immediate success.
Yeah. I mean,
buzzy, it's hard to get into, and it's yeah. packed, it's fun, it's loud, it's lively. Was it clear at that point that April was going to stick around, that she was fully signed on, or were you like, oh, maybe she'll go back to England next year? Who knows?
I mean, she was going to maybe go back to England. So I said, you know, to myself and to Mario, I think, like, I should make her a partner just to kind of, like, and he's like, yeah, you should. I mean, chefs should be partners anyway. Like, you know, this day and age of, like, the Drew Nepourants being, mm-hmm. you know, those kind of guys, the Cereos being the head guy and the chef being a hired hand were kind of over. So I made a deal with April where I said, I'm going to give you a pretty small percentage. And every year you stay, you'll get another percentage, you know. And if you leave, you lose everything. So that's a way to, like, entice her to stay. So I did that. And then after 5 years, I realized, you know, I shouldn't own a huge, much bigger percentage than her, even though I raised the money and all that stuff. Like, we should be equal partners. She's taught me way more than some employee would ever have taught me. You know, we are very much, when you think about Jagger Richards or whatever, it's like they love each other, but they don't really like each other.
Yeah.
In a way, April and I go through that. Like, we're really different. And what I wanted was a kind of loud, messy, drunken bar with great food. She wanted a bar with great food. She didn't really love the whole drunk, loud, messy part. She wanted white tablecloths. She wanted the music turned down a little bit. You know, chefs want their masterpiece to yeah. come out and not have too many things distracting you from it. She got it, and so basically we had to compromise all the time. Which
she
was
got
great
it where
me.
Though, but she didn't get it at Spotted Pig. She didn't get it at the Breslin. She didn't get it at the John Dory. Does she still want her nice restaurant?
Well, no, not that she wants a fine dining restaurant.
But you said white tablecloth.
We have white tablecloths. We also have brown butcher paper on top of the white tablecloths.
Oh,
that
well,
was the compromise.
Yeah.
No, that was the compromise.
But there's symbolically a big difference if it's just a white tablecloth. That says something different.
I think that she's learned from working with me that what we are good at is not white tablecloth restaurants.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned, you know, with Jagger Richards or you know, whoever, there is that creative tension, which at times is difficult and at times exhausting, but it's also what creates something unique and memorable.
Yeah.
And like I said, you guys took that formula. You opened the Breslin and John Dory at the Ace Hotel. You then went out west and reopened Tosca, legendary old school Italian place
North Beach.
North Beach.
Right in Columbus.
I was actually listening to the Bill Simmons podcast the other day, and he was interviewing Kevin Durant.
At Tosca.
And at the end of the interview, they're talking about how it's 1 a.m. and KD drops at it, you know, we come here on Tosca Tuesdays after the games. And I guess they were in the back room or wherever doing the interview after the Warriors won again.
Yeah.
And then that's been a big success, right?
And
sort of preserving what that restaurant, the bones of that restaurant, while sort of letting April sort of refresh the menu.
Well, yeah. And I mean, April nailed it there. And Josh, who was our head chef there, who worked with us at the Pig and the John Dory and the Breslin. What happened there was, you know, with regard to the food, San Francisco is such a foodie town that they don't have Italian restaurants, really. They have Roman restaurants and Venetian restaurants and Amalfi Coast restaurant, right? I mean, they have kind of and you know, in North Beach, they have all those, like, all the spicy seafood restaurants on Green Street and all that stuff. But Tosca, April was allowed to do kind of the greatest hits of Italian because of the seven murals depicting seven different areas in Italy. So that was, you know— there's Northern Italian and Southern Italian and Coastal Italian all in the same restaurant. That's part of the beauty of it. People love that they can go to Tosca and get all kinds of different stuff.
And Italian-wise, it takes her back to her days at River Cafe in London, which is a wonderful Italian restaurant.
Yeah,
and then coming up soon, you guys also took over in what space that I love, the Cat and the Fiddle in Hollywood and Sunset Boulevard. And when's that opening?
Probably June 1st, you know. I mean, instead of saying, you know, end of April, like I'm supposed to, it's about June 1st is when it'll be really open for real.
And menu-wise there, what's the plan?
It's up to April. It's going to be all wood-fired stuff. We're building a huge hearth it's going to be kind of the way that she, you know, a little bit older now, and I, a little bit older now, want to eat. Like, yeah. Which happens to be the way people in LA kind of want to eat. A little bit less heavy, meaty stuff, and a lot of wood-grilled vegetables and fish and
delicious, lamb and simple, stuff. Which then gets back to Chez Panisse.
Yeah. Super.
And also, you also are helping out Travis from Jelena and Giusta, speaking of wood-fired and simple vegetables, open here in New York.
45 Bond Street, yeah.
Does that have a name?
I think Jelena. I mean,
maybe.
I
wasn't sure.
I think Jelena. I think he's going to call it Jelena, but I mean, it's up to Travis. But I'm pretty sure Jelena. I mean,
and that's going to be this summer, right?
That'll probably be August.
August.
You know, July. I'm supposed to say May, but it's probably August.
Yeah. Anything else I need to know about in terms of what you guys got on tap?
We have this partnership with Ira Drucker and Richard Bourne, who have like all these great hotels in New York, and they own the Pod brand.
Oh yeah,
and we're doing another Salvation in Brooklyn.
Salvation Burger
Taco. Salvation Taco. We're doing in Williamsburg on Driggs, a big huge one. It's like 600 rooms.
Wow.
So we're doing lots of
ginormous. Space.
Yeah, that's something that we're trying to like figure out how to roll things out, do things, multiple things. So we're doing another Salvation Taco. We've never done anything twice. So we'll see how that works. White Gold Butchers is a big success now. So we're thinking of maybe doing more of those because that's working really well. We decided to open a restaurant outside of New York. So we opened on the Upper West Side. So
that was funny.
Yeah. So.
All right, well, mazel tov on all that. You're doing well. But before we go, we got to do the lightning round.
Lightning round, okay.
Either or questions.
Okay.
All right. Let's just start off going old school. East Bay or San Francisco?
East Bay.
All right. Carnitas or carne asada?
Carnitas.
Nice. Jason Kidd or Kevin Johnson?
I mean, both Berkeley. Yeah. So... I mean, I love Jay Kidd.
All right. Yeah.
I mean, he's a better player. I mean,
I'm so young that I was at school when he was there.
When really?
I broke the story in the Daily Californian that he was said no to UNC and Kansas and committed to Cal. Cal wasn't even on his list, and he was like the most recruited player in the country that year.
But he was at Skyline High School, wasn't he, in Oakland? Or
yeah. What? But then, and I noticed when I would sometimes watch the team practicing in the summertime, just playing pickup games, and I was like, who's that? That dude who's like super fast and throwing the ball behind his back, and like, where'd that kid come from? Like, oh man, that's Jason Kidd. You should know about him.
Wow.
And we called him on the phone, and yeah, anyways, that's a whole other story.
Love Jason Kidd. I mean, I like the Milwaukee Bucks now because he's the coach.
Yeah. Nudie or polenta?
Nudie.
April makes amazing both versions.
Yeah, she does. But Nudie's less carbs.
All right.
Nudie's just cheese. Okay. A little bit of carbs.
One way of looking at it.
Yeah.
Let me see. War or Joshua Tree?
Joshua Tree, one of the great albums of all time. They're both great, but Joshua Tree is one of the classic albums of all time.
Marshawn Lynch or Aaron Rodgers?
Both Cal guys again.
Yeah, well, that's the app. Yeah, you picked up on that.
I mean, you know, Marshawn Lynch is retired at age 28, so I guess if I'm putting together a football team, I want Aaron Rodgers.
Please don't buy a football team. Actually, maybe you should. That'd be fun.
Might be.
Indica or sativa?
Well, I mean, late at night, indica. Like right now, after this interview's over, sativa.
I like that you're a man with the plan. J or B?
Well, I mean, I'm a heterosexual male.
All right, final question. Butter or olive oil?
Olive oil, because I'm a heterosexual male with a big belly. and I'm old. I need to look after my heart, so olive oil.
All right, Ken Freeland, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks a lot, Ken.
Thanks.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Emma Wertzman and Carrie Polis and edited by Mitra Kaboli. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Gradys, with additional music by Nathaniel Wertzman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.